All right, let's begin. We're going to pick it up here with Paul. What to do about Paul? We didn't throw him under a bus, so we got to do something with him. Although the bus is looking good, I hear. All right, let's start with our review from last week. First, we've got the early church fathers were angry, so they misread Paul. The epistle of Barnabas. That particular writing in the second century said that the Jews lost the covenant as soon as the tablets were broke. All right, so that's a problem. Justin Martyr, this is 140. This was right after 132 to 135, which is the Bar Kova revolt, in which all of the Jewish Christians were murdered. And Justin Martyr was very upset, and you can see that in his writing. And we summarized his writings last week, and as you can see, it says, ritual and ceremonial laws as punitive and restrictive. And then finally, the Didascalia Apostolorum, we went through and broke that down. Basically, the summary was Yeshua destroyed the second legislation, which was defined in the Apostolorum, while fulfilling the first. And the reason I have fraud in the first degree is because the people in the third century, one, knew they were not the apostles. Two, knew they were not at the apostolic conference in AD 50 in Jerusalem writing this document. So as far as I'm concerned, that's fraud straight up. All right? Continuing. I came to fulfill. This is what we're going to start with today. We're going to look at it from a variety of different perspectives because you need to come away being convinced of what this section is talking about. So that's why I'm taking the time to do this. We're going to start with UK apologetics and the document that I used that you've already been sent and have read is jesusandthelaw.html. And I'm going to point out some things in his sidebar. Here we go. All who are conversant with New Testament Greek. That could cause some people to be offset the way the author writes that. And you will see why I'm saying that as I get further along. Understand this without too much difficulty. This is a prejudicial statement. Okay? So what he's trying to do is plant the seed that if you don't understand this, then you got a problem. Yet when those of a legalistic frame of mind, even more of a prejudicial statement. So what he is trying to do is color his argument by putting you in a certain frame of mind. Find this word used in Matthew 5, 17, 18. They immediately seek to distort, exaggerate its meaning. So can you see how he is presenting his argument about this word? Not allowing the simple and obvious meaning. Well, I'm going to ask this question. Who's really distorting this meaning? That's what I'm going to show you. This article opens with the range of meanings for this word are, and this is the list that he provides us. To fill up, to fill to the brim, to level up. And then he puts in parentheses, because this is from an Old Testament passage that he doesn't list, but that's okay. That is in the sense of leavening up a hollow. Okay, that's reasonable stuff. But then he follows with figurative. And anytime you see figurative, you really have to, like, pay attention. Because figurative just, I don't know, it just seems to go off. So this is what he says. The meaning would be to satisfy, to execute, to finish, or to complete. All right? Now, this is Theological Dictionary New Testament on this particular word. The author, the editor at this particular section is Delling. Okay, you'll hear me refer to him later. And what he does is he shows how these particular words do not fit with the usage of the word. Okay? So, my conclusion here is that this gentleman of UK apologetics is incomplete and misleading with what he's saying. It's kind of like he's trying to present an argument and not search for the truth. That's what I took away from his wording, the way he was using prejudicial statements. All right, let's continue. He says, in the New Testament, P-L-E-R-O-O, which is the verb that we'll find in 5:17 for fulfill in the Greek, usually has a sense of accomplishing and satisfying, as in the case of prophecies. That is a true statement. However, once again, what are we not being told? It says usually. But sometimes in our reading, we can pass over the word usually, and it's like we didn't even realize it was there. So does what he says here, is it true? Yes. But it's still not giving the full story. All right? If you had taken the time to look up the voice of the Greek word that he is referring to in all the verses that he listed, what would you have noticed? Here's the answer. They were all in passive voice, which is significant in the Greek language. Now, what about 5:17? It's not in passive voice. It's in active voice. And I'm going to show you. Here's two examples. One's from Matthew 2:15 and one's from 5:17 from Bible Works. You can see at the top, and it says, and was there until the death of Herod that it might be fulfilled. There's your English word. Look at the GNT, which is the fourth down. That's Greek New Testament. You'll see that I have bars over top of PLEROO. If you look down at the Freiburg definition, you will see that the word is passive. That's what I want you to see here. The Greek verb here is passive. Now let's look at 5:17. You'll see that at the end of the sentence it says to fulfill. Got it underlined with red. You look at the GNT, I have underlined the Greek word in red. And if you look at Freiburg, the verb is active. That is different. All right? Now, what does that mean to us? Well, here's what it means. The active voice has not been lost on scholars, and I'm going to quote Tim Haig. Of the 13 times the passive is used in Matthew, 12 are used in the quotation formula expressing the fulfillment of prophecy. 12 of them. There's another one there. It's also a past tense thing. But of the things that the gentleman was stating in his document dealing with the fulfillment of prophecy, 12 are not in active voice. They're in passive voice, all of them. Haig goes on to say, the active voice stresses the activity of Yeshua in keeping or observing the commandments. That's significant. The gentleman didn't say this. So I feel like he's not giving me a full representation of what's going on here. Just saying. That's what I came away with. How do they conclude it? So we need to understand that in verse 17, Jesus is talking about the validity of the Hebrew Scriptures. He's not talking about obedience among the faithful. That's because he's trying to apply the passive to 5:17. This would be the result. It's not passive. So this result is an error. That's what I'm trying to bring out here. He concludes with this sentence. Failure to understand this point has caused much confusion. We're all familiar with that. All right, so in like manner, let's go over to what he would call a confused Protestant Christian theologian. The name of his book is Matthew on Christ and the Law. His name is Bryce Martin. This was a PhD dissertation. Matthew and Paul on Christ and the Law, Compatible or Incompatible Theologies, which if you remember, we're talking about Matthew and Paul. We're talking about Matthew and Paul. And we're going to, of course, I have to establish this so that I can get to Paul. But he is already undertaking it. So let's see what he says here. The view that that verb means to set forth the true meaning, to perfect or to complete, has been criticized by McConnell, that's just another theologian, on the ground that Matthew would then have used the same word that is in Romans 10:4, translated in the KJV as Christ is the end of the law. He's saying that this would be the word that the law itself is the end. But Dilling, what did I say? Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. Notes that The verb is similar in meaning to, but distinguished from the verb in Romans 10:4, because this verb characteristically refers to, and I have highlighted this and underlined it because it is so important to the point that I'm going to make later. The verb characteristically in the active voice refers to filling up of a measure. And I'm going to come back and hopefully I will remember to mention this later. But it's very important because I want you to understand that I'm not saying this. This is just another Protestant Christian theologian. All right. This is from the book of John. As we get ready to unfold this, I need you to understand the thinking patterns of the people who would have heard and understood what Yeshua said. Therefore said some of the Pharisees, "This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day." But what was the man really saying? "Because he keepeth not the Sabbath day correctly or according to how I think it should be done." That's what he was really saying. So the ellipses is huge in that passage. But what you can see here is that the Pharisees are, they have a way, and if you're not doing it that way, that could be a problem. So with that in mind, let's start at 17. "Stop thinking that I have come to do away." Stop thinking. People have seen him not follow the tradition of the elders in certain places, and according to their definition, that means he's doing away with the law. So he says, stop thinking that, because I haven't come to do away. Let's look at the whole verse. "With the law of the prophets." Why do I have prophets bracketed? Because some textual evidence, including Hebrew Matthew, some of Hebrew Matthew and some Greek, do not have the prophets. Now, it's insignificant as far as I'm concerned, because sometimes you'll have the law, the writings of the prophets, sometimes you'll have the law, sometimes you have the law and the prophets, and I don't think it's an issue for us, but I had to tell you that it was there. "I have not come to do away with the law, but to fill it full." What did I just say about the definition that was brought out by Dilling in Theological Dictionary of the New Testament? Filling it full of what it's supposed to have. All right, let's continue. The Greek, kata, down, and L-U-O, for loosen. It's mainly used in the Torah and the writings for loosening and putting down of saddles and burdens of caravan pack animals. So you can see, if a person is going to interpret that, well, I can heal on the Sabbath, but the people are teaching that you can't heal on the Sabbath, you're loosening the restrictions of the Sabbath that have been established. You're not doing away with the Sabbath. You're still in the synagogue. You're still observing the Sabbath. You're still not working. But you are loosening the restrictions. The Greek word is a fit. Now, Rome, number 53, that's the manuscript that's held in Rome. They have the Hebrew word for uproot, which I thought was interesting. And you'll see more of that as we go along. All right? EB, even bone, also known as Shem Tov. It's the latest one of all. Their Hebrew word is breach or violate. Once again, not too far away from the Greek word. Let's go to verse 18. Pay attention. Or if I was speaking with Phil's family, it would be, yo. "Until heaven and earth pass away" is a circumlocution. "Not one jot or one tittle shall pass away from the law" means one cannot divide the law into parts so as to do away with a specific part. How many times have you heard, "Let's divide the law up into ritual, ceremonial, and moral, and we'll just keep the moral"? Problem is, 18 doesn't allow that. All right? "Till all things come to pass." From where I'm sitting, quite a few things have not come to pass. Now, here's what's misleading, KJV. They put the English, F-U-L-F-I-L, as though it was the same Greek word as the last word of 17. But it's not. It's not the same word at all. It clearly means come to pass. And so sometimes our English translations, depending on the word that editorial committee chose, could cause us to think, well, I wonder if that's the same word or not, when really it's not. And it's a completely different meaning. All right, let's skip 19 and go to 20. You'll understand why in a moment. "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter." Now, here's my question. What does that mean, "you shall not enter"? Does that mean you shall enter? I thought it meant you shall not enter. You know, I mean, all right, here's my thoughts. Spirit and obedience only can get you in. The reasons, 1 Corinthians 6:9, Ephesians 5:5, and Galatians 5:21 all say the same thing. If these items are in your life, you shall not inherit the kingdom. Paul is clear. All right. Now, I'm not going to break down spirit and obedience right now. We'll see if we get around to it later. Flesh shows a lack of understanding and will keep you out. Now, I'm going to demonstrate this with Romans 10 because we've already covered it. But I'm going to go back and cover it again. Here we go. Romans 10:1. What does Paul say? He desires that his brethren would be saved. That's good. I like it. All right. I don't have a problem with that statement. But what does he say in 2? They have a zeal, but they are in pursuit incorrectly. That's what he says. Got zeal, pursuit is incorrect. 3, even more clear, being ignorant of how God wants his children to reach righteousness, the right standing, they established their own path. And I'm going to define that later because I found some incredible Protestant Christian quotes that explain exactly what's going on. Awesome. And verse 4, Yeshua is the way for God righteousness. And this works for everyone who believes. The Spirit, from the Father to the Son, from the Son to us. This is how we achieve the right standing. Accepting Yeshua is how to get it started. Problem is, some of the Pharisees rejected Yeshua. And that was a problem. Now, yes, I know that Acts 21 says tens of thousands. And then after the prophecies came fulfilled, the destruction of the temple in 70, a whole lot of people became that way. And then as you get to 100, you can see that the number of Jewish believers in Yeshua is growing so great that they have to conspire a way to put them all to death. Nevertheless, even though there was tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands, there were some Pharisees that rejected Yeshua as Messiah. All right. This is the law in the Sermon on the Mount. Here is the first statement. Society, as we know it, needs specific rules. I like that. Ideally, such rules act as a restraint on evil and serve to inculcate virtuous behavior. That's a definition on page 1. Society is the better, where its laws are good and wise. And we could find passages in the Scriptures that would support that. The risk in a theocracy is that a body of such laws will be confused with an exhaustive statement of divine will. The ink on the paper, known as Torah, is not the final answer. The ink on the paper will never be the final answer. And that was the problem of Romans 10. Let's continue. That compliance with concrete, practical rules will be interpreted as the essence of the righteousness required by God. And it's not. Now, I'm not down on Torah. I like Torah. But ink on paper is not going to get it done. Just ask a lawyer. Maybe there's one in the room. In fact, true goodness, what do we know about true goodness? Matthew 19:17. What happened? Why do you call me good? There's none good but one. All right, let's continue. Though it will express itself in ways no law would condemn, I'm glad Paul put that in Galatians 5, is not the same thing as careful compliance with ink on paper. Because ink on paper, well, it would take a lot of paper and a lot of ink to cover every possible situation that could occur for 10 billion people across 6,000 years. It's a lot of paper and a lot of ink. That's not the answer. Labored compliance, while a vast improvement over unprincipled living, this guy is a great writer. I like this guy. I got to look at some of his other stuff. Falls far short of the spontaneous selfishness and concern for others, the uncalculating generosity and kindness, the unstinted love of God and all his creatures, which God desires to flow from his children. Why did I put non-preprocessed? We discussed this when we discussed C.S. Lewis, Rats in the Cellar. Your character always appears when you don't have time to pre-process the situation. That's the reality of it. If you've got an understanding of Torah and you can post-process it, you can make the right decision, God bless you. But pre-processing, or the lack thereof, reveals the true character of mankind. That's why I put that in there. His word was spontaneous. The early Christians, convinced that God had found it necessary, I've highlighted that because I disagree with this. The early Christians convinced that God had found it necessary to intervene in human history in an awesome way. One, did God intervene in human history in an awesome way? I think he did. But what I disagree with is that he found it necessary. And that implies to me that this was an afterthought. And I don't see the plan of redemption as an afterthought. I see the whole thing as being known by the Almighty from the beginning. But that's me. Okay, that's just me. Could only conclude that sinful humanity, that's flesh people, cannot of its own produce the goodness God desires, not even with the assistance of the divine law. Ink on paper is good. Ink on paper is not going to change your character. Okay? He continues. A tree must be good before its fruit can be acknowledged as such. People can fake fruit. That's the problem we run into sometimes. But you can't fake non-pre-processing. That can't be faked. In Paul's terms, such goodness can only be the product of a life transformed and empowered by the divine spirit. Isn't that absolutely the case? I know. You're sitting back there and going, can you tell me something I don't know? I understand, but I have to make my case. You know how it is. All right, continuing this gentleman's quote. In short, the Sermon on the Mount, that's 5 through 7, does not prescribe in a concrete, comprehensive way the behavior expected of God's children. For such behavior is neither reducible to nor the straightforward result of compliance with a corpus of rules. Do you hear what I'm saying? Ink on paper. It's good as far as it goes. It doesn't go far enough. It will not change your character. And so that's why I agree with this gentleman. In some aspects, this is my opinion, I just want people to understand where I am. I think sometimes the Torah might define a minimum standard. If you're not even reaching that point, you really need to re-examine some things. Okay. All right. Rather, the Sermon on the Mount provides illustrations of the kind of attitude and action which will and must characterize those who thrill in what it means to be children of a benevolent Heavenly Father. And I'm sure that's a really excellent sentence. It wasn't how I would have ended. I would have ended on something more grandiose there. But, you know, this is true. We've got some examples, but what we have to be is far beyond the limited list of examples. All right? Not telling you anything you don't know. All right. Let's go back and look at Matthew 5, 17, 18, forget 19, and 20 in my translation. Stop thinking that I've come to do away with the law. I have not come to do away with the law, but to fill it full. Pay attention. The law is here to stay. Do not attempt to divide the law into parts. Everything stands until all things have come to pass. Therefore, to enter the kingdom, your righteousness must exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. Close? Close? Okay. I liked it. All right, now let's go back to 19. Whosoever therefore shall break one of the least commandments and shall teach men, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. We're familiar with verse 19. But let's break it down as a structure. Whosoever therefore shall break, that means they don't do. And shall teach men so. Teach not to do. They don't do and they teach men not to do. All right? But what does it say? Whosoever shall do and teach to do. Now, what is this talking about? Yeah, I got a couple ideas. Could be talking about Bema. I don't know. It's a possibility. Probably not, but could be. I had to put it in there. Got to give it a place to for discussion. It's got to be part of open discussion. Let's look at the word. This is from Greek English Lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature. This is one of our heavyweights. The word was commonly used of laws or decrees which were rendered void and were therefore of no lasting consequence. That's the word used in verse 19. Yeah, that's not good. Perhaps as we walk in the Spirit, another thought of mine, but selectively observe, then as a living epistle, our actions teach others what we believe. I don't know. I can get a little bit of mileage out of that. I think it's something we have to be aware of that exists. Let's go to Hebrew Matthew and see what those particular documents say. First, we'll start with Nestor. It says, subtract, delete, cause to be lacking, which, think about it, makes more sense with verse 20. If your doing does not exceed their doing, you will not enter into the kingdom. So if you do not do and you teach others not to do, you will be deleted. Ouch. Rome 53. He shall be legally charged in the realm of the heavens, and he shall be liable to the law. This is late. It's kind of rabbinic feel, doesn't it? Realm of the heavens. Okay. This is another document that quotes Hebrew Matthew, but it's not a Hebrew Matthew, and they had deleted. And finally, EB has vaporous. I don't know. Those who don't do the law and teach others not to do the law will be like a vapor. You know, they may float away into the effervescent existentialism. I don't know. Okay, summary. Yeshua's discussed character traits of the redeemed in 1 through 16. Think about 1 through 16. I was quite entertained at some Protestant Christian literature which said the keeping of what they want believers to do is impossible to do. By the flesh, yes. But did Yeshua do it? Well, how did he do it? By the Spirit. Hey, there's an idea. Put to an end the idea that his interpretations were setting aside of the Torah, and then in six examples, starting at 21, probably to 47, contrast the interpretations of the religious leaders with what was present in the Torah all along. What was present in the Torah all along but was never brought out? Fill full. Okay, let's continue. This is back to the Matthew paper. The context of 5:17 through 19 and 5:20 through 48, as we have seen, this is a Protestant Christian theologian, upholds the enduring validity of the law. Wow. In this paper, this is how he opens. By contrast, it will be argued that Matthew does have a coherent total view of the law. Why is he saying that? Because some other theologians said that Matthew really messed this up bad, was clueless about what he was talking about. And he's saying that's not the case, that 5:17 to 19 and 5:20 to 48 are internally consistent and correlate with each other, and that each passage upholds the enduring validity of the law. Once again, I tell you, this is not a Hebrew roots teacher. This is a Protestant Christian theologian who is part of the new perspective of understanding that Yeshua kept the Torah and Paul kept the Torah, and now we are reevaluating. This view, like the one which claims that nothing will ever pass from the law, agrees with our previous conclusions concerning the law in Matthew. What are those conclusions? The law is valid. There's a polemic against the scribes and Pharisees who are taken away from the law. What do we know about Deuteronomy 4:2? Do not add, do not take away. In addition, both views would affirm the exceedingly emphatic point of 5:17 to 19 that nothing is ever going to be taken away from the law. Can it be said any more clear? All right. Here's what I got. As a witness, Yeshua has emphatically restated the Torah as filled full by his teaching, doing, and the Spirit shall be in you, divine enablement, that's in John, will be ongoing even after his death and resurrection. That's what it means by until all things come to pass. Because another point that Protestant Christianity used to use was that, well, he meant that really the law would be in effect for the 3 years that he would be alive and then it would be done away with. Okay? But now they've stopped that. So that's good. All right. Now, this is what Yeshua said. But Yeshua is only one witness. We need two witnesses as a minimum. Here we go. I need to show you a circumlocution, just so we can be clear, because I'm going to show you another circumlocution. For every beast of the forest is mine. What does every mean? Every. And the cattle upon 1,000 hills. So, my question is, who owns the cattle on hill number 1,001? If we're literal, we have an issue. But if we're figurative and understand it as a circumlocution, we do not have a problem. All right, so I just wanted to bring that up, because now I'm going to give you another verse with a circumlocution. Here we go. Witness number one. Know therefore that Yahweh the Elohim, he is the only true Elohim, the faithful El. By the way, there were many Els at the time, but he's the faithful El, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him and guard his commandments. Where have we heard guard before? To a bunch of generations. Thousands is a long time. Even if you take this literal, it's a long time. If you take it as a circumlocution, it's a long time. So in the end, our conclusion is, it's a long time. All right, what does that tell us? Witness one, Yahweh through Moses. Witness two, Yeshua. Here is my conclusion. The matter is determined. Torah does not end at the death of Yeshua. No matter what you read, think, hear, sense in the rest of the New Testament, you have got to have a foundation to work from. This is my conclusion. All right. What's up with Paul? Paul, looking back at Matthew, what does 21 through 47 teach us about Yeshua's halakha? He's filling full as a demonstration. Certainly, if he lived a number of years, and they followed him around, and they wrote it all down. It'd be a lot of ink on paper. And that's good. And we got a few of them. All right. But what he is doing conceptually is filling full, so we're not doing ink on paper. What does Paul understand about the man-made traditions and their role for believers in the new ecclesia? I have to ask that question because Matthew is dealing with this exact problem. The Pharisees and whoever are seeing Yeshua's interpretation of the Torah as a loosening, and that is a problem for them. So Matthew's trying to establish that, listen guys, it's this halakha, not this halakha. There's two halakhas working here, and Matthew is trying to address that for the assembly of Jews that he's addressing in the decades that follow the life of Yeshua. He didn't write this the day he said it, just so we're clear on that, okay? All right, so Paul's got the same problem, and Paul is facing this. And Paul's going to address it, but before I get there, we have to do UMJC. Here's the link. Let's do it. One way is the unique role that the Jews have, and one that is completely removed within the law, one law theology. What's one law theology? It means that the Torah is for Jews and for Gentiles who join Israel, that they all fall under the same Torah. That's one law. Is it an across-the-board rejection of the authority of the Jewish people to define the halakhic parameters of how the Torah is to be applied? Completely removed from what we believe. Right? One law theologians have no desire to defer to the halakhic standard normative of the Jewish people, because in doing so would remove any basis for the idea that Gentiles could be obligated to the Torah the exact same way as Jews. Why is that? Because if you've read the Talmud, you will see that the Gentiles only have to do a few things. Of course, they'll still not make it in, but you know, they don't tell the Gentiles that. Judaism has always rejected this idea, and rightfully so, because they need to be exclusive. In rejecting the right and the responsibility of the Jewish people to define what it means to be Jewish and practice Judaism, one law theology strikes directly at the core of what? Authentic Judaism? For those of you who know Mindy, that I work with her in our food ministry throughout the Richmond area, she was going to Chabad, and she decided to take one of the classes at Chabad, and so she's in the class. It's the first class on Judaism, and the rabbi steps up. I know this because she called me immediately. The rabbi steps up and says, let me be perfectly clear. This is not the Judaism of Moses. This is the Judaism of rabbis, and it is nowhere close. And she immediately got on her phone and called me. She said, you won't believe what the guy said. But UMJC says, in rejecting the right and responsibility of the Jewish people to define what it means to be Jewish, what we believe strikes directly at the core of authentic Judaism. Wow. I can't even wrap my head around that. One law replaced the Jewish rabbis and sages with self-appointed Gentiles who believe that they are divinely sanctioned to interpret Torah outside of the Jewish context. This doesn't get any better. What conclusions they come to are given a greater weight. I put the S because he didn't. Given a greater weight than those of the Jewish halakhic authorities. Now, here's his closing statement. That can be compared to the rebellion of Korah. You know what? I know this brother personally. I've sat and talked with him. And I'm a little concerned. I'm a little concerned. And I might add, if there was a Jew of Jews, who would that be in the first century? I'm going to pick Paul. That's who I'm picking. All right, so let's find out. We see what they're saying, that we are in rebellion as bad as it gets. Does Paul concur? Is the question on the table? Well, why don't we find out what Paul wrote? Let's do it. This is Ephesians 2, 14 and 15 from the Greek New Testament. We will break down every word as we go. First word, T-O-N, the. N-O-M-O-N is law. We're used to nomos, N-O-M-O-S, but this is just a different form between accusative and nominative. Doesn't matter. Next word, T-O-N, of the. Commandments. All right, now. Some people say this is not the normal word for translating commandments in the Septuagint of Torah. Let me give you some examples of how this word is used so we can make a case. Matthew 5:19. Whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments. 19:17. Why callest me good? Enter into life, keep the commandments. 1 Corinthians 7:19. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping the commandments of God, ellipses, is everything. Revelation 12:17 and 14:12. Who attacks the seed? Those who keep the commandments of God and the testimony of Yeshua. So, you know, I don't really have a problem with this word for commandments. All right, let's continue. I put this up there so it'll show up in the slide. When you get the PDF. The next word, E-N is I-N. Now, let's look at this word. D-O-G-M-A, S-I-N. Forget the S-I-N. That's just a form of the Greek. What is the word? Dogma. Let me break it down this way. Dogma. It didn't change. Dogma is never used in the Septuagint to translate Torah. Never. Never used. It's always the decisions of mankind. Now, a decision by man could be good. And a decision by man could be bad. In Acts 16:4, the Acts 15 is a decree. And in Acts 17:7, the decree is of Caesar. So you're good. Good and bad. It's all human. But it's never used to define Torah in the Septuagint. All right. Let's look at the last word. This is kat-a-Jesus. The basic sense, caused to be idle or useless. All right? I'm breaking it down step by step. The term always denotes a non-physical destruction by means of a superior force coming in to replace the force previously in effect. Okay, now I know I have you out there hanging on a limb. But that's okay, because you're going to see it. Example of this would be light destroys darkness. Freiburg goes on to say, released from a former sphere of control. Now, where did this all start? We want to find out what Paul thinks about the traditions of the elders. Let's look at my translation of 2:14 and 15. For Yeshua, who hath made both Jew and Gentile one, has broken down the middle wall of partition between them by causing the law of the commandments and the dogma to be destroyed by means of a superior halakha coming in to replace theirs, which was previously in effect, releasing us from their former sphere of control. So, it does not look like Paul is supporting UMJC. Okay? Now, before we leave this, I have to give you a bad Ephesians 2. You know, we always have to do a bad one. Okay, this is the NIV. He has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. So as you can see, that editorial committee and me are not in total agreement here about what this passage is talking about. All right, let's continue. Without question, Yeshua, with corroboration from Matthew and Paul, has definitely declared the following. The Torah will continue to exist past his death. Yeshua's halakha is the accurately revealed, filled, full will of the Almighty versus that of the elders. This is what I've gotten out of this thing that I found. All right? Now, let's talk about Paul. Paul. The system prior to Yeshua. Learn the Torah as interpreted by the elders. Oh, yeah, Acts 15:10. I put that in there because I've actually seen Protestant Christian theologians write this. They'll say when Peter's talking about the burden, he's talking about the law. But the thing is that Yeshua is saying that by the Spirit, this is what you have to do. You're not even going to get in. So, while I'm not going to break down Acts 15 because we've already done that, I'm just saying that that's something to take note of. In the beginning, learn all of Torah, interpreted by the elders, take oath of obedience to obey it all. You see that in Galatians 5. Circumcision, mikvah, and now in Israel equals you're saved. That's the old system. What's the new system? Accept Yeshua. Order behavior after Leviticus 17 and 18. That's Acts 15. Learn Torah on the Sabbath for minimum reference. That's Acts 15. I put plus because some of the Torah is character-based, but some other stuff you have to actually do. Make conscious decision not to satisfy the flesh. That's Romans. I think you can go 6, 7, 8 there. All right, so let's talk about Paul's roles in more detail. As believers are asked to leave the synagogue, new fellowships arise. You read the book of John, I think it's 3, 4, 5 times, where he specifically says that you will be asked to leave the synagogues. Okay? The people coming in are unfamiliar with Torah. And since being changed into his image is not an overnight thing, let me assure you that that's the case. They need some guidance on how to behave until... which sometimes contradicts current social customs. But we just saw this in our 3-week study on 1 Corinthians 11. Okay, let's continue. Also needed is how leadership's to function. But remember, he says a lot of stuff, and it's not to be nailed down to the dirt. Since some Jews are present in most, if not all, the fellowships, and I put in most, if not all, because While I can support from the New Testament that there are Jews in are present in most, I'm not sure I can make a case that Jews are present in every one from the Scriptures. I don't know that I can make that case, so that's why I'm saying it that way. And understanding about the old traditions must be clear. Some of the old traditions violate the new stuff. All right? Some new traditions are also needed for the benefit of society looking in. We talked about the angels, but I'm not talking about the angels right now. I'm talking about society. Then there's also some changes as the restoration of all things commences. Example, male priest. Now it's priesthood of believers. That's a change. The two covenants are not identical because there are no female priests in the Levitical system. That's a difference. Paul brings that out. He also has to deal with attacks from outside false religious systems. Colossians 2 is probably Gnosticism. There's some debate about that, but it certainly does look like it. Now, what are our problems? Paul answers questions and complaints, but we're missing the first half of the discussion. How many people have ever overheard a phone conversation? That's a challenge. We lack understanding about the culture of the first century in Rome and Greece. If you haven't read history, well, that's all I'm going to say. We have to work backwards from our English to Greek to Hebrew to Aramaic, and let me assure you that is no easy task. If you're just going to read your English Bible selection, there is a good chance, maybe I should even increase that to high probability, that some things are going to be not understood correctly. We sometimes lose sight of what has been established when we come to obvious contradictions. For example, 1 Corinthians 11, 5, when a woman prays or prophesies, that requires a vocal action. But 1 Corinthians 14, 33, 34, no vocal action in the assembly. And by the way, just so you know, now that we're finishing with Paul and coming back to women, I will deal with 1 Corinthians 14, 33, and 34 in complete detail in my next meeting. And I think that that will take 3 seconds. And then there's textual criticism. All right, now listen, textual criticism, we've been through a lot of that, and I am affected just like you are. Let me just give you one example. One of my favorite verses, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I was really upset when I found out it wasn't there. I was like, oh man, I love that verse. But I'm okay because I got the Hebrew children. But you know, it's this type of thing. Textual criticism is here and it ain't going away. All right? If Paul is making sense, life is good. Of course, life hasn't been good that much recently. If something doesn't align, like a clear contradiction, we need to be more diligent. Perhaps we should consider that. Do not be afraid of the school of textual criticism. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Yeshua called Paul. James and Peter confirmed him. That's early Galatians. So we should give him a chance. Right, Paul? Moving forward, where do we go from here? Here is a profound statement. One step at a time. We've got to take each one of these things and be sure that we're given equal weight. We're evaluating the culture, the language, the TC, all of these things. Got to look at all of them. That's why we have a team of believers who are all digging this stuff out. And then we begin to come to a conclusion that's not poured into concrete. We need to enforce the holy kiss equally with all other commands of Paul. From here on out, everybody must kiss everybody else. You know, isn't it funny how we pick and choose some Paul commandments? Let's do this one. Oh, I don't want to do that one. How about a little more consistency? Develop our own chart of what we know so we have a foundation to evaluate what Paul says. I recommend that because I did that. I have my own chart, and I use it when I read Paul. so that I can have a clear understanding of what's taking place. And I'm recommending to everyone to consider developing your own chart of what you know as a foundation. It's a suggestion. Okay? So ends my presentation. Amen. All right. I will take questions for 7 minutes.